I'd like to begin with a miracle, but since I'm not at the level where I can manifest them at will, I'd like instead for you to at least imagine a miraculous situation. So please imagine that the snap of my fingers, a sudden worldwide wave of illumination occurs through which every person on earth becomes fully informed of all of the facts about genetically engineered foods. And everybody's opinion becomes suddenly fully aligned with science. Okay, now if such a worldwide wave of enlightenment occurred, what do you think would happen? Well, if we adhere to the routine rhetoric of the proponents of genetically engineered foods, we'd have to predict that this universal flash of enlightenment would cause all opposition to them to vanish. Because in the rendition of reality that they promulgate, the opposition has been based in ignorance, and all of the concerns about risks have been purely due to a lack of scientific understanding. But in reality, in the concrete world that we actually inhabit, the phenomenon that would rapidly vanish is not the opposition to these foods, but the foods themselves. That's right, if the actual facts became widely known, the entire GE food venture would quickly collapse. And that is why, despite their repeated pretensions about wanting to educate the public, many of the people who promote genetically engineered foods have suppressed or distorted crucial facts. Moreover, this twisting of the truth has reached massive proportions. My book documents case after distressing case in which eminent scientists and scientific institutions have stooped to deception in order to enable the GE food venture to advance. And it demonstrates that if the truth had been told and the facts openly aired, these novel products would never have come to market, and I wouldn't be here discussing them with you tonight. I wouldn't have written the book either. There would have been no need. Now further, the sheer magnitude of the deception in itself demonstrates how strongly the evidence weighs against the safety of these products. Because if the evidence were truly as supportive as the proponents claim it is, there would be no need to distort it. That's just a no-brainer. So let's examine some of the key claims about the safety and acceptability of genetically engineered foods and compare them to the actual facts. An exercise that will make it clear why widespread knowledge of these facts would doom the colossal venture that's producing and promoting them. Now, let's begin with one of the biggest and most brazen instances of deception. And in order to fully appreciate the immense impact of this incident and the profound role it has played in fostering the illusion that genetically engineered foods are no riskier than conventional ones, I'd like you to contemplate the following scenario. The year is 1992, the month is May. The first genetically engineered whole food is slated to hit the market within the next 18 months, and several others are going to be released a few years afterward. A substantial portion of the public are concerned because they believe these products do pose abnormal risk, and so are many scientists. They hold the same concerns. Further, it's not clear how the world's various governments are going to regulate these products and what kind of safety testing they may impose. Enter the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, a dramatic entrance, making a major pronouncement in the form of a policy statement about genetically engineered foods, declaring that a task force of its scientific experts have been extensively studying the issue and have overwhelmingly concluded, A, that producing new varieties of crops through genetic engineering is substantially different than doing so through conventional processes. B, that it entails higher risks, including the inadvertent production of novel toxins and allergens that could be very difficult to detect. And C, that therefore every genetically engineered food needs to be carefully tested before it enters the market. The FDA statement then acknowledges that many other scientists have similar concerns to its own experts, and it asserts that the agency will definitely follow its experts' advice, not only because requiring rigorous testing is scientifically sound, but because it's also legally mandated. Mandated, explicitly mandated, by the U.S. food safety laws. Laws that require that such foods with novel additions be demonstrated safe through scientific procedures and demonstrated safe to a very substantial degree of certainty. Now, you don't need a doctorate in social psychology to figure out what would have happened if that scenario had actually played out. When I asked the head of food safety for Australia and New Zealand what she thought would have resulted from such a revelation, she promptly replied that it would have killed the entire GE food enterprise. And it's difficult to see how it would not have, which is, of course, why that scenario never played out. However, it's important to point out that most of the details in that scenario that I just laid out for you did occur. They're historically accurate. Many members of the scientific community were concerned about the risks, and so were the scientists on the FDA's biotechnology task force, who did express their concerns and did call for rigorous safety testing in a series of memos submitted to their superiors. Moreover, the agency's files indicate that it fully knew that numerous scientists outside the agency were also concerned about the risks, and that there was definitely not a consensus about safety within this scientific community. But the FDA's policy statement was the fictional aspect in that scenario. It did not reflect those realities as the scenario said it did. In fact, it misrepresented the realities, and its main claims stood in stark opposition to the scenario that I laid out. So in actuality, what the FDA declared in that policy statement was A, that there is an overwhelming consensus among scientists that GE foods are so safe that they don't need to be tested. B, that the agency, the FDA, was not aware of any information showing that these products differ in any meaningful way from foods produced via other methods. And C, that it would therefore allow them to be marketed without any testing whatsoever. Of course, nobody outside the agency was aware of how egregiously these declarations were deceiving the public and Congress. And that's because the agency kept all of the scientists' memos well covered up, along with all of the other documents in their files that contained troubling information about genetically engineered foods. And these memos only came to light because I organized a lawsuit that forced the FDA to divulge them. Otherwise, we still wouldn't know. We wouldn't really understand that the FDA had been lying back in 1992. But now we know. The proof is there. Very clear proof. And by the way, a copy of the key memos for years has been posted on the website of the Alliance for Biointegrity. That website is www.biointegrity.org. Many of them are quoted from in my book and in other articles I've written. I could quote several now, but there are several other things. I'm hoping you'll take my word for it so I can move on to some other points. But unfortunately, even though they were divulged and I made them public at a well-publicized press conference in Washington, D.C. in 1999, most of the public and most members of Congress still are unaware of them. And that's because the mainstream American media has kept them covered up. And there's a whole chapter in my book on the malfunction of the mainstream of American media when it comes to coverage of biotechnology. And I have presented irrefutable proof that the FDA has been misrepresenting reality, continues to do so. And even when investigative reporters have really drooled at the chance of breaking that story, it's been shut down by the higher ups, either the editor or somebody higher up, time and again. Print media, radio, TV have had the information. Somebody wanted to go ahead with it. It never got out to the people who needed to hear it. That in itself is a very, very, it tells a lot about why genetically engineered foods have progressed the way they have and why so few people are unaware of the true facts. Now, of course, why would an agency entrusted with ensuring the safety of our nation's food supply engage in such delinquent behavior? Well, in 1986, when Ronald Reagan was president, his administration adopted a policy to promote the U.S. biotechnology industry and to ease the introduction of its products onto domestic and foreign markets. And ever since that year, the federal regulatory agencies have followed that policy, that promotional policy. And that policy has also been embraced by every successive White House, Republican and Democrat alike, including the current one, the Obama White House, which in many ways may be pushing genetically engineered foods at least as hard as any of its Republican predecessors. You know, the Food and Drug Administration has even explicitly admitted that it has a policy to foster, those were its words, to foster biotechnology. But unfortunately, as we've just seen, it has been pursuing that policy through illicit means. And as we shall see, it has also issued other deceptive statements in pursuit of that policy. Now, not only are most people unaware of the unsettling conclusions reached by the FDA scientists, they're equally in the dark about an earlier set of unsettling facts. Facts about how the very first ingestible product of genetic engineering caused a major and deadly epidemic. That's right, although the technology's proponents routinely claim that no one has ever been hurt by consuming one of its products, it's incontestable that the very first product that that technology produced, when it hit the market, also hit thousands of consumers with great harm. Dozens were killed, and thousands, according to the last estimate of the Center for Disease Control, between 4,000 and 5,000 were seriously sickened, hundreds of whom are still invalids. And that epidemic occurred in 1989, here in the United States primarily. Now, many of you may not be aware of it. In fact, most people are not. I've spoken with public health professionals who were flabbergasted when I give them that information. They said, "How come I never heard of it?" And I said, "Well, there's been tremendous suppression of the facts, and the facts that couldn't be suppressed have been distorted." There's an entire chapter in my book on that unfortunate incident. But the evidence as a whole, despite what the proponents of genetic engineering would tell you, the evidence as a whole not only shows that genetic engineering has not been absolved of complicity in causing the unusual toxic contamination that befell that product. I should actually have specified what that product was. It was a food supplement of an essential amino acid, specifically L-tryptophan, which we all need, and which many people who were nervous or had trouble falling asleep were taking supplements for. And for years and years, millions of people probably, certainly hundreds of thousands, had been safely consuming L-tryptophan supplements here and around the world. There had never been a problem. And then, when one of the manufacturers realized that if it applied the new technology of genetic engineering to the bacteria that were being used by all the other, it and the other manufacturers to synthesize the L-tryptophan, if they gave those bacteria through recombinant DNA technology extra copies of some of the genes, their own genes, that are involved in the synthesis of L-tryptophan, those bacteria would churn out more L-tryptophan in the same amount of time, and they could make more money. So that's what they did. They genetically engineered those bacteria, but unfortunately, the evidence indicates that in the process of synthesizing the L-tryptophan, the overstimulation, the overproduction, caused some aberration in one or another metabolic pathways that resulted in one or more unusual toxins that contaminated the product. And the toxins were present at minute levels. You have to understand that tryptophan tested pure, pharmacologically pure. It passed all of the standard pharmacological tests. So according to pharmacological tests, that was pure. It shouldn't have hurt anybody. In fact, there ordinarily is contamination at that minute level, but it's so small it can't hurt anybody. It's hard to produce a supplements like that without a little contamination, but most of them aren't toxic. And even if they are, again, at that level, they shouldn't be harming anybody. But the toxin or toxins that did exist in that supplement were highly unusual because they were highly toxic at very, very low concentrations. And the evidence as a whole does point, doesn't prove, but points toward genetic engineering as the most likely cause of that contamination. Now, that chapter of mine is quite comprehensive, and one of the expert, probably the leading expert in that whole incident, who was a professor of biochemistry and pharmacology at the Mayo Clinic when the epidemic occurred, and he and his colleagues studied it extensively, studied the L-tryptophan, studied all the information they could get on it. They actually identified all of these six case associated contaminants. He reviewed that chapter and he strongly endorsed it, and he stated that that discussion of the tragic incident, as well as its ominous implications, is the most comprehensive, evenly balanced, and accurate account that I have read. I'm stating it because that chapter basically contradicts the standard claims you will hear, and it's important, I think, to be on record, to have Professor Nagel's statement on record as to how sound and accurate it actually is. So if those facts, the facts I just related to you, and especially as developed and specifically in my book, if those had been openly reported, instead of being obfuscated, and they were badly obfuscated, the genetically engineered food venture may well have been curtailed even before 1992, and the FDA wouldn't have even had to make a policy statement. Now, even if an accurate airing of the facts about the toxic tryptophan tragedy, even coupled with the FDA having told the truth in 1992, would not have stopped the GE food venture, then the additional telling of the truth in regard to the first genetically engineered whole food, which came to market in 1994, almost certainly would have driven the venture off the rails. Because there were safety tests done on that food, even though they hadn't been required. And the manufacturer, that food was a genetically engineered tomato. It was actually dubbed the Flavor Saver tomato. And the Calgene, the company that was that produced it, sent the data, the safety testing data, to the FDA for review. And that's the only, to my knowledge, the only genetically engineered food for which the FDA scientists actually got original research data. It's unique in that respect. When they reviewed the data, the pathology branch and other experts uniformly agreed that the data raised a safety concern that showed some unusual unusual lesions in the stomachs of the rats didn't prove they were dangerous, but definitely did not demonstrate safety. And they made that point very clear in memos to their superiors. The data raises a safety issue. That issue has not been resolved. This food has not been demonstrated safe according to the legal standard. More tests are needed. What did the FDA administrators do? They decided that it would be very inconvenient, not only for that product, the first whole food produced by genetic engineering, but for all products currently that were then in the pipeline, and for the whole event, the future of the venture, if what the scientists said actually got publicized. So those memos were also covered up. And as unfortunately has become habitual among FDA decision makers when it comes to genetically engineered foods, the FDA released a press release stating that its scientists had thoroughly reviewed the data and concluded that no safety issues remained, and that the tests showed that that tomato was just as safe as every other tomato. An outright lie, but it worked. The tomato came to market. Nobody was the wiser, and most people still don't understand what the FDA scientists said. So again, you can get a feeling for how deep the deceptions have run on this. And it's almost certain, I think, that if the three episodes I've just recounted had been truthfully reported to the public, there would not be any GE foods on the market today. And if there were any, there would be far fewer, and they would have at least undergone far more rigorous safety testing than any genetically engineered food has yet been required to undergo. That would have at least happened, stricter testing that has been required anywhere, even in the European Union. Now, I know some of you may be thinking, well, even if these early incidents were not accurately portrayed, the fact remains that a substantial number of genetically engineered foods have been on the market for many years now. And for many years, there has been an overwhelming scientific consensus that they are safe. And also no reliable tests, you may be thinking, have detected that they've caused any harm. And for another thing, we need them to feed the world's burgeoning population. However, although it wouldn't be surprising if several of you are entertaining such thoughts, their apparent reasonableness is itself the result of additional misrepresentations. And it will be very easy within the next few minutes to demonstrate that none of these notions is true. For instance, let's take the claim that you repeatedly hear from the proponents of genetically engineered foods that there's an overwhelming scientific consensus that they're safe. In fact, one of the strongest pronouncements was made in 2012 by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. It declared that, quote, every respected organization, unquote, that examined the evidence has determined that they're no riskier than conventional ones. And they did say that, every respected organization. Well, that flies in the face of a few very important facts. For instance, in 2001, the Royal Society of Canada issued a report concluding, one, that it is scientifically unjustifiable to presume that genetically engineered foods have been demonstrated safe through any of the tests that have been required, and B, that the default prediction, and those were the words used in the report, the default prediction for every genetically engineered food should be that the genetic alteration has induced unintended and potentially harmful side effects that could be deleterious to the health of the human or humans or livestock that consume the foods. And that report has never been revised, nor has it been retracted. Moreover, the British Medical Association, the Public Health Association of Australia, and the editors of The Lancet, one of the world's premier medical journals, have all expressed concern about the risks. And the Australian Association recently called for a complete freeze on growing and marketing the products. And in 2015, a peer-reviewed journal published a statement signed by more than 300 scientists asserting that there is not a consensus about the safety of genetically engineered foods within the scientific community, and that their safety has not been adequately demonstrated. Now, the claim that no research has ever showed problems, that's also very off the mark. In reality, many well-conducted studies published in peer-reviewed journals have detected harm to the animals that ate genetically engineered food. In fact, a systematic review of the toxicological studies on these foods that was published in 2009 concluded that the results of most of them indicate that the products, quote, may cause hepatic, pancreatic, renal, and reproductive effects and may alter hematological, biochemical, and immunologic parameters, the significance of which remains unknown, unquote. It also noted that further studies were clearly needed. Another review that encompassed the additional studies that had been published up until August 2010 also provided cause for caution. It concluded that there was an equilibrium between the research groups suggesting that GE crops are as safe as their non-GE counterparts and, quote, those raising still serious concerns. Between 2008 and 2014, 8 such research reviews were published. And although some interpreted the data more favorably for GE crops, as a whole, they provide no grounds for unequivocally proclaiming safety. As Sheldon Krimsky, a professor at Tufts University, observed in a comprehensive examination of these reviews that itself was published in a peer-reviewed journal, quote, one cannot read these systematic reviews and conclude that the science on health effects of GMOs has been resolved within the scientific community. Yet, GMO proponents routinely claim that it has been conclusively resolved and that safety is a certitude. By the way, that last sentence was for me, not a continuation of Professor Krimsky's quote. Just want to set the record straight on that. I'd like to just share with you a summary of some of the research that really is quite disturbing, that you don't hear much about, or if you do, it's only because it's being viciously and unfairly attacked. One study was a 2-year study conducted by a group of university-based researchers. It was on one of Monsanto's varieties of Roundup-resistant corn, or maize, and it was published in a peer-reviewed journal in 2012. Now, Monsanto had previously conducted a 90-day study on that crop and declared it was fully safe. But the research team conducted a new study feeding rats the engineered maize for 2 years instead of the 3 months that Monsanto had used in its study. Its study was only 90 days, only a medium-term study. So this group wanted to see what would happen if we do a long-term study, which is more realistic because livestock and humans are going to be consuming those foods over a much longer time. And most foodborne illness is not acute, it's chronic. It's caused incrementally and can build up over many years. So it could take many years to notice that there's a problem going on. Further, not only was their study longer than Monsanto's had been, it was more comprehensive, and it was also better designed because it could distinguish between the effects of the Roundup herbicide that would be applied to the crop and the effects of the genetically engineered crop itself, so that they could try to isolate what are the effects of the herbicide, if any, and what, if any, are the effects of the genetically engineered corn if it's been unsprayed, because they were testing unsprayed corn as well as the sprayed variety. And the results were highly damaging to the image of the Roundup-resistant crops because they demonstrated a high degree of damage to the rats that consumed them. The data revealed that Roundup and the GE maize each independently caused serious injury. So Roundup was fed to the rats independently, just added to their water in similar doses that the rats would get from eating the food, and it was found that in itself caused serious problems, as did eating the genetically engineered corn without having been sprayed by any of the Roundup. And they revealed that there was serious injury to the livers and the kidneys, abnormal onset of large tumors, and increased mortality. Such problems had not been seen in Monsanto's study because they take longer than 90 days to develop, several of them. For instance, the first tumors didn't form in male rats until the study had gone a month longer than Monsanto's. The first tumors in females didn't appear until the 7th month, and most of the tumors weren't apparent until 18 months had elapsed. Further, the kidneys and the livers weren't the only organs adversely impacted. Statistically significant damage was also detected to pituitary glands, mammary tissues, and all the negative effects were observed for the three basic categories of experimental rats, as I mentioned. Those that ate the GE maize that was sprayed with Roundup, those that ate unsprayed maize, GE maize, and those that ate no GE maize and instead were given a small amount of Roundup in their drinking water. Because regulators have often not required any toxicological feeding studies and have never required any longer than 90 days, and the European Union didn't get around to doing that until 2013, this study showed that a bioengineered product that had gained worldwide approval based on a 90-day study still could induce comprehensive harm over the longer term. Therefore, it threatened to discredit the entire regulatory system and to undermine the entire GE food enterprise. And of course, that's why the proponents have viciously and unfairly attacked it. But my book, other books, several articles have demonstrated how unjust and unsound those attacks are. And it is published in a peer-reviewed journal as I speak. Also, it's important to note that even the shorter-term studies have actually often detected harm that has not been reported by the industry-sponsored research. When a team of university scientists, that same team, examined the data from 19 of the feeding studies on soy and corn varieties that had gained approval. They gained approval, they were on the market, and these were products comprised 83% of the GE foods that people had actually been regularly consuming. They found that 9% of the measured parameters, including blood and urine biochemistry and organ weights, were significantly disrupted in the animals that ate the GE food. Moreover, the greatest disturbances were to the kidneys of the males and the livers of the females. And the scientists emphasized that because livers and kidneys are the major reactive organs in cases of chronic food toxicity, these results should be viewed as danger signs, something which unfortunately the regulators had failed to do. But aren't genetically engineered foods, even if they entail risks, aren't they needed to boost yields so that we can make sure that the world's burgeoning population is properly nourished? Aren't they needed to meet the nutritional requirements of the third world in particular? Again, the facts show otherwise. They are not needed, very clearly not needed. And in fact, probably the most comprehensive, most important study that has been conducted on the future of agriculture and various technologies and the role that they can be expected to play in meeting the world's food needs was conducted, it was a four-year study that was completed and published in 2008. It was sponsored by the World Bank and four United Nations agencies, and it's called the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development. And it was conducted by more than 400 experts from 80 countries. 58 governments have endorsed it. And its assessment of genetic engineering flew in the face of the promotional claims by concluding that this technology is not essential for solving the problem of hunger. Interestingly, when the project's director was asked at a press conference, which announced the release of the report, he was asked point blank whether genetically engineered crops were the answer to world hunger. He replied, "The simple answer is no." And there was one form of agriculture that the study did strongly endorse, and they stated that that's where the resources should be put, that's what should be developed, that's where the future of farming, especially in the third world, should, that's what the future of farming should be. And it was small-scale agroecological farming, which using organic or near organic methods, but clearly organic, clearly low input and sustainable forms of agriculture that small farmers can do without having to buy a lot of industrial inputs. That's what they recommended, solidly. Now also, there have been several other reports too that show that genetically engineered foods are not needed. For instance, one UN report, a different UN report, surveyed 114 farming projects in 24 African countries and determined that through adoption of organic or near organic practices, yields had increased on average over 100%. Okay, on average, the yields were doubled. And in a report by the UN Special Rapporteur for Food, he stated, this is another report, that in 44 projects in 20 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, some of those were probably the same studies in that report I just mentioned, but there were more studies as well. Using these agroecological techniques, these 44 projects, yields increased on average 214% over a period of 3 to 10 years. And he stated in his report, that is far more than any genetically engineered crop has ever done. So they're not needed. That's another fiction. You might be asking, well, okay, you said that the media has been complicit in keeping the facts covered up, but still, if the evidence is so overpowering, how come the scientific community, how come very few people in the scientific community seem to have bought into all of the promotional claims? How come there isn't more vigorous debate going on here and at other universities? Well, there are several good reasons. Let me share with you one very telling research, very, very revealing research study that provides a very good part of that answer as to why you're not hearing more vigorous debate within the scientific and the academic community. Now, this study was conducted several years ago. The situation is probably worse today. It was conducted at a major American university, and it measured attitudes toward biotechnology among agricultural and nutrition science faculty and extension staff, the extension staff who advise farmers. And it found that 63% of these individuals had reservations about the safety of genetically engineered crops, 63%. But they were expressing the reservations in private to the researchers conducting the survey, because the researchers found, these people admitted that although these people were actually in the majority, most of them probably didn't realize it because they had indicated in the survey that they were not comfortable in expressing their concerns in public, in faculty meetings, in any other format, because of the attacks and the oppression that would sure to come down on their heads. And so they were all silent in public, and they didn't even know they were in the majority. They thought they were just, you know, in a small minority, but that wasn't the case. Now, in contrast, the strongly pro-biotech minority said that they were very comfortable expressing their views. So the 37% who strongly favored GE crops and who freely voiced their support for them projected the false impression that they were the majority. Now, as I said, that university is a major university. In fact, it's an Ivy League institution. In fact, it is this institution. That survey was conducted here at Cornell. And I have a feeling the repression and the intimidation is at least as strong today. Many people afraid to speak up for fear of never getting tenure, or if they've got tenure, being ostracized. There are examples of even emeritus professors having their offices taken and all the privileges taken away if they voice science-based concerns about genetically engineered foods. I can't state that emeritus professors here that that's happened to. I know of certainly one case at Australian National University, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are many others. But I think most of you know that there's very strong pressure to stay on the pro-GMO bandwagon here at Cornell. And it shouldn't be happening. It shouldn't be done. Fiction should not be propagated as science. Certainly, and propaganda should not be masquerading as sound science. You know, fiction is quite appropriate in the literature department. It has no place in any department of science. It has no place in biology, no place in agricultural science. Facts should prevail. Facts should always trump fiction, and fiction should always be exposed as fiction, but that hasn't happened. And I hope that some of you here will be emboldened to try to do what you can to wake people up and to get the facts out. Because as, well, I mean, I can speak boldly myself. I know what the facts are. I wrote a book on it, and among the experts who praised the book is a distinguished fellow at Iowa State University who has stated that if the revelations in my book become widely known, then the arguments being used to defend genetically engineered foods will be untenable. Now, actually, they're untenable right now. It's just in practice they're tenable because of all of the misinformation that is masquerading as scientific knowledge. So really, it is not at all unrealistic to state, as my book does, that this whole venture to genetically engineer our food is quite vulnerable, so vulnerable to the facts that if the facts were fully aired, it would topple. It could all be over within a few months. I mean, at least the main thing. It could be exposed quite easily if a few key people were to become fully informed, or at least better informed, and said something, did something. People whom the media couldn't ignore and couldn't pass off as some kind of anti-science kook. So I still am optimistic. I believe in science, although the other side tries to paint me and people like me as being anti-science fanatics. Actually, I'm trying to uphold, restore the integrity of science. I'm trying to uphold the facts. And I have challenged Monsanto and scientific institutions to read my book and to refute it, to even prepare a list of any state assertions of fact that they can demonstrate are false. So far, they've run from it. They haven't done it. Monsanto in particular shied away from doing it, even when media asked them what they were going to do about the challenge. So I'm confident that the facts are on the side of caution, and I also do believe in science, and I believe that ultimately truth does triumph. In ancient Sanskrit, it's expressed this way, satyam eva jayate, truth ultimately triumphs. I believe that it will, and I hope some of you will join in that endeavor to allow truth to prevail over propaganda. Thank you very much.